This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we speak with Dr. Maya Sheetreat, MD, who is a neurologist, herbalist, urban farmer, and author of The Dirt Cure, and her new book, The Master Plant Experience. She has been featured in The New York Times, The Telegraph, NPR, Sky News, and more. Dr. Maya is the founder of the Terrain Institute, where she teaches earth-based programs for transformational healing, including training programs for psychedelic-assisted approaches. For many years, she works and studies with Indigenous communities and healers from around the world, and is a lifelong student of ethnobotany, plant healing, and the sacred. Today, we talk about what psychedelic medicine is. We talk about trauma and how trauma affects the body. Dr. Sheetreat dispels some misconceptions about master plants, or how many of us are now referring to them as psychedelic medicine. And she explains how folks with physical or mental health diseases could benefit from psychedelic medicine. This was a really interesting conversation, and we know you'll enjoy it. Now, on to the podcast. Hi, Dr. Sheetreat. It's wonderful to see you again. And I'm really excited to host you on the podcast and talk about your new book, The Master Plant Experience.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I loved your first book, The Dirt Cure. And I would just love for you to just describe what inspired you to write this new book and where the inspiration came from.
Well, it's kind of a funny answer to this question, which, you know, usually you would think someone would be planning to write a book and have this idea and everything. And I actually was resisting very much writing a book about psychedelics. And, you know, I was talking to someone about a memoir I was working on, and she said, you know, I think you really should write a book about psychedelics also. And I was like, no, absolutely not. That's not going to be my thing. I'm not doing that, you know. And then she said, okay, you know. And then I thought about it and I was like, well, I already teach a whole program on psychedelics. So maybe I'll just write a little kind of handbook to go along with it. And we thought it would be maybe like 25,000 words, just kind of to go along with the course that I teach. And 85,000 words later, I had apparently a lot to say, and I ended up really diving deep into, you know, there's a lot that can be said about certainly any topic and definitely psychedelics. And for me, I realized I really did have a very specific point of view as a neurologist, as an integrative neurologist, as an herbalist, as someone who's studied with Indigenous people for over a decade and come from my own Indigenous lineage, I realized it wasn't about talking about all psychedelics. It was about bringing my particular way of thinking and paradigm to the topic specifically of master plants. And so it was a little bit of a kicking and screaming kind of event, if I could call it that. But in the end, the book became something I think that was unexpected and something I felt really happy to share.
Well, I'm really glad you wrote it because your book is very well structured and very interesting. And something that I love that you bring in from the very beginning is just, why are we all sick? And it's very individualistic community. And I think there's a lot of talk about how loneliness is impacting our health, but I don't think we've expanded our mind into the type of community that you describe. So what is your definition of community and why are people falling into some of these illnesses?
Yeah, and this is a perfect bridge from The Dirt Cure, right? Which was all about being in relationship with like germs and food and nature, and that being like kind of the foundation of our health, to really talking about that in a bigger way, right? In terms of, first of all, being in relationship with ourselves is not just a mental thing, right? Like, it's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, I would say creative and ecological, right? So we have this community just of all of the different variations and angles and aspects of who we are. And practically speaking, we're in relationship with every cell in our body, right? So this is something that I enjoy doing with this book, was bringing in a lot of systems biology and complexity theory into the book, where just understanding that we don't even really exist outside of relationship. All of the cells in our body in some way have decided with intention, right, to come together as part of a system that makes me, Maya, or you, Amanda, a being, right? And then there are these microbes also who are part of that community, and they're communicating, both of them, microbes with cells, cells with each other, microbes with each other, probably through our interstitial system, which we now are actually discovering. And I just got to have a dinner last night with the person who discovered this, that the interstitium is really an organ by which microbes and cells communicate electrically. So we're in this community within our bodies, and then we're part of a community around us, which is not just people, not just family or pets or the people that we might think of in our neighborhood, but actually also air, water, seed, soil, sun, you know, this bigger ecological community. And then we're part of a community that's also outside of time and space, like ancestry, right? We now know even epigenetics are a perfect example of understanding the way what happened to our great-great-grandparents can affect us now and can affect many, many generations going forward if we're not kind of in conscious intention and relationship with what we do with our bodies, all of those bodies, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and so on. So community is something incredibly rich. And now that we know, just even for example, that our microbes are determining things like our cravings, our memory, our cognition, our sleep, our mood, not to mention immunity, hormones, and other things, we're actually nothing. Who are we without all of these relationships? We're really only these fluid beings all the time.
So how does our understanding of science change as we start to think in the context of systems biology and indigenous wisdom?
No one really talked about the microbiome when I was in my training, just for example. And certainly, you know, I came out of my training and ended up diving into the microbiome because of my son, you know, which I ended up writing about in the Dirt Cure, but nobody was talking about the gut-brain connection at that time. No one even really knew about it. And not that long ago, probably 10 years ago, there were all these papers coming out basically looking at the immune system and basically saying all research we've ever done on the immune system is probably not accurate because we didn't take into account microbes in terms of the microbiome, right? And like brain explosion to see that admission in a peer-reviewed paper published in a major journal, people are starting to realize that how we thought about our bodies and science in general, when we try to kind of break everything down. I mean, there is a place for that reductionist approach, but it's been so dominant for really like the last 400 to 500 years that we've really missed, right? Like literally we've missed the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the things that you've learned from indigenous folks outside of your traditional medical training that lended to your wisdom in this, the master plant experience?
Well, so I'll talk about that on a personal level, and I'll also share, if it's okay, a little bit about how we all rely on Indigenous knowledge in medicine. From my standpoint, I mean, the way my Indigenous teachers and the people I've learned from think about, they already think about everything in a systems-based way. Nothing is this sort of reductionist idea. And, you know, it's funny because in terms of master plants, I mean, they don't, the word psychedelics is like, what even is that? You know, like they don't talk about master plants as compounds or chemicals or tools. That's like a favorite of everybody. Oh, this is a tool. You know, they talk about them in a much more like as entities, really, and as kind of bringing wisdom, right? So they think of everything. And of course, when I say Indigenous, I just want to be really clear. I don't speak for Indigenous people, who are a very diverse, incredibly diverse group of people, cultures, views, and so on. So I'm just sharing what I was taught that is across the different teachers that I've had, that I've been allowed to share. But even when it comes to the psychedelic or the master plant, they're still thinking about relationship. Everything is relational. Everything has to do with the context, the land, the person, the family, the people, the culture. And that is so profound, I think. And really, it's not that that wasn't already something I thought, but they gave me so much more language. And I understood that that actually was and has been the way we as human beings have really always thought about health and about well-being, and, you know, is through community and through relationship. But from the standpoint of really Indigenous science, because I think people, and I know this is how I was taught, like Indigenous people have these like primitive ideas and they could never, you know, they're not advanced, they don't have the technology and so on. You know, I bring in some examples in my book of how, first of all, probably about 75% of pharmaceuticals come from Indigenous knowledge, coming from like the Amazon and the jungle. They knew things that if we had these pharmaceutical industry or anthropological researchers going and just walking into a rainforest with hundreds of thousands of different plants that all kind of blend together, would they have really found all of these pharmaceuticals and knew how to use them? Probably not, right? And when you ask Indigenous people how they learned the way these plants work, they say the plants told them. And the anthropologists were like, obviously, no, you know, that's just some kind of delusional thing. And that's not, you know, we're happy to take the knowledge, but it was probably just trial and error. That's been this kind of long-standing idea. But when we look at even like the ayahuasca brew, right, it's so difficult to imagine this pretty nondescript vine. I mean, ayahuasca is very potent, beautiful vine, but really it's not like bright purple or, you know, I mean, in a jungle of like tons and tons and tons of other plants, you're not necessarily going to be like, oh yes, this. And then you have to cut it the right way, cook it for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, and then mix it with another plant that has DMT, because ayahuasca actually doesn't contain DMT, which is technically the hallucinogenic compound. It has something that prevents us from breaking down DMT. Blocks are one of our enzymes that breaks down DMT in our digestive tract. And then you have to cook them together in a particular way and serve it in a particular way. And they didn't have molecular analysis. They didn't have PCR. They didn't have any of those things. They learned it through their visions. And so that was just very fascinating to me to really understand that there's been so much that we've based Western medicine on, certainly pharmaceutically, all on this Indigenous knowledge and science that comes from things we've really devalued, but you know, we wouldn't be where we are in Western medicine without it.
A lot of our medications actually originate from plants. Do you mind running through some examples of a common medications that we know that come from plants?
Yeah, I mean, well, we know like a lot of the medicines that have come from plants, one of them are certain anesthetics. So it actually, you know, and that's another, I mean, I don't want to get too derailed by these origin stories, but certain anesthetics actually came from like the poison arrows, you know, like curare, that again, only is effective if it's injected or put under the skin, but wouldn't be effective at all as a paralytic if it was ingested by mouth. And how was that discovered? They were using actually curare to poison the tips of arrows so that when they were hunting monkeys, the monkeys wouldn't become stiff in the tree, and then they would have to actually go procure them in that way. They wanted them to be paralyzed so they'd fall out of the tree if they were hunting them. And curare actually went on to become the basis of paralytics that we use in anesthesia, which now of course are made synthetically, but that's just one example. I mean, others are like Taxol is another one. I mean, a lot of the most potent medications that we have come from both not just the Amazon, but from plants, right? And so, and they are often poisonous, I want to add, right? And understanding how to use them as pharmaceuticals in the right dose and the right amount has all been something that was derived from indigenous knowledge.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing. And you mentioned that psychedelics isn't necessarily the term that indigenous folks use when they're talking about these plants. So that's why you called it, you know, the master plant experience. But because our vernacular, we're mostly calling these psychedelics, do you mind just describing what some of these master plants are? Like, what are psychedelics?
Sure. So I think a lot of people think of psychedelics as drugs, right? And so one of the things that I, you know, I like kind of delving into that concept of what's the difference between like a psychedelic and a drug. But I'm going to start with what is the psychedelic / master plant. And so psychedelics are really neuroactive, psychoactive compounds that are consciousness shifting. And master plants are, so I'm going to give some examples of master plants, which are like ayahuasca, San Pedro cactus, peyote, the psilocybe mushrooms, Syrian rue. So there's a number, count really many, many psychedelic master plants. And not all master plants are psychedelic. Master plants are actually very specifically neuroactive, psychoactive plants that could include like cacao, could include coffee, could include tobacco, would include the coca plant. So they're very powerful consciousness shifting plants, but not necessarily psychedelic. So any psychedelic is a master plant in plant form. But psychedelics also include like LSD, ketamine. MDMA technically isn't a psychedelic. It's an empathogen, but it's kind of put under that umbrella because of the kinds of similar experiences that people have.
Thank you for defining those. And so I think that we talked a little bit about why people are experiencing more of these mental and physical illnesses because we're disconnected from community. But you also specifically focus on trauma and the role of trauma. And I would love for you to just define what can trauma mean to people? Because I think some people think of like PTSD, but people can have like minor traumas in their life that can really cause physical and mental ailments. And then how some of these master plants can help people kind of resolve these or deal with the traumas they've experienced.
Sure. So I want to just start by saying a lot of what we think and do and how we operate comes from programming that we have between the ages of 0 and 7. So though that period of time is a very important time of our lives, because we're learning how to be a human being in our families, in our communities, in our schools, in our cultures, right, in our religions. And so it's one of the most intensive periods of life. And of course, beyond that, we're still learning and practicing, but 0 to 7 is very particular. And what happens sometimes during those periods is that we can have big events, which can be what I would call capital T trauma or small T trauma, right? So the capital T trauma is, you know, what we would call like adverse childhood events, ACEs, and there's a lot of literature on this now. But, you know, things like abandonment, divorce, physical, sexual, mental abuse, having a family member incarcerated, addiction in the family, and so on. Things that are unfortunately actually quite common in our society. And then there's small T traumas, like you said, which are less profound. Not everyone knows or agrees that those things are traumatic per se, but a person can experience, like bullying, for example. One person might walk away from that unscathed, another person might be really traumatized, right? And trauma is not the event itself. Contrary to how the word is used, it's actually how our bodies remember the event. And it changes our bodies. It changes our, you know, there's a lot of data on this now that our nervous systems are actually different, not just sympathetic, parasympathetic, you know, fight or flight, but the structure of the amygdala and, you know, the way the brain actually is wired shifts based on the kinds of experiences that we have, particularly in childhood. And that definitely also can happen later in life as well. I'm bringing up that early childhood because it's a period we mostly don't remember very well, but it's so impactful for life, for our entire lives. It changes, these events change us literally down to a cellular level where we experience something called the cell danger response. And this is the work of Robert Navio at UCSD, where he really showed that our cells enter this compromised state. And it could be due to a physical challenge, right? It could be an infection. It could be, you know, an accident, et cetera. But it can also be related to mental or emotional or even spiritual challenge of some kind, because cells don't necessarily speak, you know, they don't change how they express the cell danger response based on the particular instigator. They just go into this compromised cell danger mode. And what happens in cell danger mode is that the cells are less connected. They don't operate in the same way. And even our mitochondria shift from being communicating with one another in this kind of relational information exchange to what kind of a meatball mode where they're not in communication with one another. So all the way down when we experience a trauma, all the way from how we experience life as human beings down to a cellular level, things shift so that we are in cell danger mode. And that can persist. If we're lucky, we're in cell danger mode for a period of time, which is normal, and then we recover quickly. But if we don't have the right container and the right ability to process and, you know, therapeutic supportive environment, then we can get stuck in cell danger mode. And that's something that can become, it can be lifelong until we find our way out. And the longer we're in it, the harder it is for us to find our way out, because we've developed really deep grooves, right? These pathways that are built from the cell danger mode. It even affects our microbiome. So the makeup of our microbiome is different. Our hormones are different. The way we think, the way we remember, everything shifts based on these experiences that we can have. And so psychedelics and master plants in particular can help shift all on every level, from a cellular level, from an epigenetic level, from a microbial level, we're starting to see, from a plasticity level, right? Getting ourselves out of those grooves that we can get stuck in that are what cause symptoms, right? Which are what we really care about, like anxiety, major depression, PTSD, addiction, eating disorders, right? All of these different conditions that are very difficult to treat in our current Western medicine model. Psychedelics offer a way to reprogram and shift a lot of these cell danger the cell danger perspective that we're living in on a cellular level and up to a more healing and restorative kind of model.
Do you have any examples of folks who were maybe diagnosed with anxiety, depression, PTSD that weren't helped by the regular Western forms of treatment that were made better through psychedelic medicine or master plan experiences?
I mean, there are so many, like, and I would say, you know, people need just to literally pick up the New York Times and, you know, and I say this, I mean, not to be kind of, you know, I'm not trying to be clever here, but really just to say there's study after study after study after study. And pretty much most major institutions around the world now have psychedelic research centers, or at least major funding towards psychedelic research because it's so promising. And I don't think it's the panacea and the answer to everything. I want to just say that clearly in the same breath that I think that there are, there's a lot of potential for healing. But, you know, people who have, I mean, we could just talk about alcohol addiction, cigarette addiction, heroin addiction. I mean, seeing people come out of that at rates that we just have never seen in any therapy that we have. It's just, it's profound. I mean, from tobacco addiction, for example, people were, I think at the end of a year, over 60% of the people who had had just two psychedelic macrodose experiences with support before, during, after, all of the studies have support before, during, after. This isn't like just go into the basement and do, you know, I mean, this is done in a very therapeutic way. Over 60% of those people were still tobacco free at the end of that time. And there's really like for just from this standpoint of cigarette addiction, there's just no treatment. It's unprecedented to have that kind of success from addiction. And we could talk about, you know, major depression in a similar way. People are also going, you know, who have terminal illness, who have major anxiety, fear, depression, facing their own death, are having experiences with psychedelics that are helping them go move forward with a sense of peace and calm and happiness. I mean, to me, like, of course, there are always going to be potential downsides to every therapy. Anything that's powerful is going to have the potential to really help and the potential to hurt also. So we're always going to have to be really respectful and careful, which is why part of why I wrote my book, because I wanted people to have the broad perspective. But at the same time, to see what these medicines can do with just one dose, two doses, it's unlike anything that we have available to us right now.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting opportunity for people who have struggled with these diagnoses and haven't really found an answer yet. But there has been a lot of resistance in the past to psychedelic medicine. And I think a lot of it was, you know, based on the drug war and history and who was benefiting from what. But what are some of the misconceptions about psychedelic medicine or one of them that you wish to dispel and that can move some of this more forward in the research and as a way to help people with their trauma?
Well, I mean, just to say part of why I think that psychedelics were so stigmatized in the after the 50s and 60s, most people don't know there was actually very intensive and promising research going on at that time for OCD, for depression, for anxiety. There was quite a lot of academic research. But at the same time, a lot of academics, I mean, it was sort of a little bit also of a free-for-all. And that was on the part of many academics who thought, you know, all professors should be, you know, having psychedelic experiences. All students should be having psychedelic experiences. And even, you know, our government and our military were doing a lot of experimenting with psychedelics through this project called MK Ultra. So there was a lot of, I would say, irresponsible, if I could. I mean, it was exploration, but it was really with a lack of understanding of the power. And so there was, because of that, negative outcomes, real negative outcomes. People, you know, people got hurt, they hurt themselves, they ended up in hospital emergency rooms, having bad trips. It's out of vogue right now to use the term bad trip because, you know, they say challenging experience, like we get the experience we need. No, there are such thing as very bad experiences that people come out of and feel much worse than they did beforehand. And, you know, it's important to understand, again, that I don't want us to make the same mistakes that we did before, right? Again, understanding, even in indigenous cultures, master plants are not considered good or bad. They're considered to be powerful. And it really has to do with, how do you come? Do you come with reverence? Do you come with respect? Are you coming in a good way? What are you going to do with the gifts that you're given, right? If you have something healed by the master plants, what is now your offering, right? What are you going to bring to the world? So these are the kinds of approaches. And I wanted to be clear about that because I think, again, a lot of the misconceptions and stigmatization really came from our lack of understanding of who and what we were dealing with. But that said, you know, just as an example, when we think of master plants or psychedelics as being drugs and addictive in many cases, there's a lot of concern about that. So actually, we know that master plants, at least in their whole form, I don't know, because there's a lot of designer molecules now being made that I don't know what those are going to do. But and when I say designer molecules, I mean by pharmaceutical companies. But when we come in a respectful way to the experience, it actually, as I've said, can reverse addiction, can treat addiction. And that's incredible, right? That's an incredible possibility that we have available to us in a society where that's a huge, huge problem that we're facing. So that's one example. And, you know, and I think really understanding that there is, you know, that anything can be a drug if we abuse it, right? And so it comes down to, how are we going to engage? And I'm just, you know, I'm always going to go back to that, is understanding that these have the potential to be very, very helpful to us if we are careful and come in a good way.
I really love that answer because I think we do this a lot in general in our society, where we overdo on one thing. Like there are certain like sugars that are better in full plant form, right? So you don't want to isolate the specific compounds because it might not necessarily have the same benefits or risk to your body as if you ate it in like the full plant form. And like you were saying, the pharmaceutical companies are now creating these like designer compounds, and we don't really know what the ramifications of those will be because they're not in their natural form. So I think there's a lot of misconception about how we use these plant medicines. How would you recommend this to someone who may be able to benefit from this experience?
Well, I'm going to answer sort of the first part of what you said, and then the second part, which is a little complicated. Both of them are a little complicated, but the first part is just to say, you know, I want to kind of remind people that we have been down this road before, not with psychedelics per se, but with, the opium poppy, right? Also a master plant, the coca plant, right? Another master plant where we purified a particular compound that was like the what we call like the active ingredient. And that's all we were interested in, and created, you know, basically a pharmaceutical. I mean, that's what cocaine is. That's what, you know, opioids are. And we're still cleaning up the mess, and will be, I think, for quite a time to come, from the way that we engaged. And maybe I just wanted to make sure I shared that, because I keep talking about how we how to come in the right way. And I want to show a little bit about how it looks when we come to a master plan without that respect and without really understanding that these are, you know, these are considered sacraments for millennia, for communities, indigenous communities that were wisdom holders, that took care of the land, the plants, the spirits in their mind, and the people, all with these medicines. And so for me, part of how we come in the right way is by being in conversation with indigenous communities, which does not mean we all fly to Peru or Ecuador or wherever to try to, you know, have the authentic experience, because actually that is interrupting a lot of indigenous people being able to access their own medicine. And it's interrupting indigenous culture in creating a lot of actually issues with, you know, neo shamans and that don't have the lineage or the ethics. And so it's creating actually dangerous situations for people both in, you know, kind of Western countries and in South and Central America and elsewhere, where, a lot of things are happening that you might imagine would happen when people are in very vulnerable situations or quite ill, going somewhere and being in an incredibly vulnerable situation by having alteration of their consciousness, right? So we want to be really, really thoughtful. And for me, part of why I wrote the Master Plan Experience was to open a conversation around what kind of next steps, how do we find this new way, right? We're not all going to go back and be indigenous. And we're also not probably prepared for the kind of way to engage that we're in right now. So all that said, to answer your question, how do I recommend people engage? Well, first of all, we're in a period of real transition right now. There's a lot of decriminalization going on. So there's only there are very few places where right now psychedelics are legal. The state of Oregon, though, is one of them. And there's a whole, you know, it's kind of a litmus test for what can happen, what could happen. But there are a lot of places now where there is decriminalization. So that does not mean it's legal to engage with psychedelics. But depending on what's in that decrim legislation, it means it is the lowest priority of law enforcement for people who have a very small amount, meaning they're not like opening a business or something, to engage. And then there are places where it's still illegal and a felony, right? And it's actually funny because it's, you know, they're being equated to very, very dangerous drugs that we know are incredibly harmful. And these are not in that way. But nonetheless, this is the situation we're in. So people can engage through studies. People can go to places where it is legal or decriminalized if they choose to. And that is growing more and more and more. I mean, there are many cities in California, in Michigan, Washington, D.C., Denver, Colorado, right? I mean, it's happening all over. I know there are right now, you know, in Connecticut and New York, there's a lot that's happening. I think this is going to be pretty quickly, at least available. But right now, I don't recommend people go and do things that are illegal in their area. So I just want to be clear about that. But assuming somebody was in a place where it was legal, I do think from a safety standpoint, and I'm a doctor, so I'm going to be thinking about it in that way, having somebody with you, you know, not just going out. I'm not going to say that, you know, I mean, one of the things that I really had to engage with was my own prejudice in writing this book. My own prejudice around, you know, young people, you know, many of us in our, you know, formative years as teenagers and so on found our way to whatever psychedelics might have been out there, and, you know, rave culture. There's a lot of people, a lot of young people who find their way and had transformative experiences with that. You know, so I had to really come to terms with, like, we do find our way to these rites of passage, whether we are allowed to or not. But I do think that having, from a harm reduction standpoint, right, making sure people don't get hurt, having somebody there to be with, when anyone is altered, outside, inside, wherever you are, you want someone to make sure that you're safe, and that if you need help, you know what to do, where to go, and so on. So at a minimum, I do recommend that. But what I hope is that we're going to have access to people who are trained professionals, for the people who, especially for the people who really are coming for therapeutic help. Because that's really, I think, where my focus is most, is not like, how can we all, right? I'm not speaking to the how can we all go party crew. I'm speaking to the people who have been stuck in their lives in various ways, you know, sad, stuck, sick, I think of it as, and who need support. And I do think that all of the benefit we've seen in studies has been for large experiences. We're not talking here about microdosing or quantum dosing, but for large experiences, all of that is only really in the context of therapeutic support before, during, and after.
A few cultures and groups of folks that I've heard about use these master plants historically and in the present in ceremony. How do we practice ceremony around master plants? What does that look like today for those of us who aren't necessarily part of those traditional groups?
Well, absolutely. And I want to say about ceremony, and I do explore this quite a bit in my book, that ceremony can happen anywhere. It doesn't have to be, right? I mean, ceremony can happen in your backyard. Ceremony can happen in a hospital room. Ceremony is really, it's really about a container for transformation. And as you said, coming with a certain reverence and respect and willingness to surrender. Ceremony can also not happen where you expect it to happen, right? You could go all the way to some, you know, foreign psychedelic retreat somewhere, and it could be very much not like ceremony because of the kind of space that's held by the people. So I think understanding, and I think this is actually part of what excites me, I should say, about psychedelics or master plants being incorporated into our current medical model, is obviously not that we just do the same thing we always have done and make it into like a pharmaceutical, but this idea of like expanding our conversation to be not just physical and maybe mental, but also emotional and spiritual and ecological, right? Because part of macro dosing of psychedelics, and I do think there's therapeutic benefit to micro dosing, sub psychedelic experiences, and quantum dosing, which is vibrational. But from a macro dose experience, I think the mystical experience is something that's been outlined in research, not just me using a vague term, but the mystical experience is thought by a lot of these researchers to be a major reason that these are so healing, right? So it's like that ability to connect with what's bigger than us, what's beyond us, the connection to nature, the idea that we're not surrounded by things, but by beings, all of these aspects of the mystical experience are considered to be exactly why psychedelics and master plants in particular are so healing for us in our very materialistic, linear society.
Well, Dr. Sheetreat, this has been a wonderful conversation. Super enlightening. I love your book. And we always finish with the last question for all of our guests. The future is blank.
Hmm. So So I would say the future is relational.
I love that.
I think, you know, as we understand that we've been conditioned in this us versus them way of seeing the world and thinking about the world, and we're understanding that we're just a universe within a universe within a universe, and that, you know, everything is connected to everything else. I think that's going to be the future, is understanding how we're all really connected.
What a beautiful future. Well, thank you so much. And I highly recommend the Master Plan experience. It's really enlightening, especially with how much people are talking about psychedelic medicine right now in the social media space and the media space. So you do a really great job of outlining your wisdom. So I really appreciate you sharing it with everyone.
Thank you so much.